Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio as we reach around the world to Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England, Indonesia, even the small town of Smithville, Indiana, and all across North America. And we appreciate you tuning in once again tonight, or maybe you're catching us on the download because we are available forever on the download, so please tell your friends. As always, our studio producer, Melissa Hovey, technical engineer, Wayne Larson, music done by tonight our good friend Shelley Leibowitz, our guest, Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. We're going to be talking sharks. Of course, it is Shark Week on the Discovery Channel, so this is a perfect time to talk a little bit about sharks and other marine life. And as always, from his now renovated and modernized studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and usually prompt Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Well, good evening, Mr. Batson. That's right. We've got an inside bathroom now, and it is so nice.
Oh, I'll bet it is. I bet the staff really appreciates that.
They do.
And we're enjoying weather that is unbelievable for the month of August.
Yes, we are.
75 degrees. I cannot believe that. We want to remind everyone that our program tonight is brought to you by our main number one underwriter, Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Weekend and Expo. It's out now for $4.99, the big video. It's pretty amazing at ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com, available for $4.99. It has hours and hours of what happened that particular weekend with Steve Calls, Billy Willard, I can't talk, Melissa Hovey, myself, and of course the infamous Bob Gimlin, so you want to be sure and check that out. And as always, they make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for August 15th. Now, last week we started out our news in Florida with the turtle signs going up all over the beaches there because the turtles are coming in to nest. Well, guess what else is coming in? Wind currents are pushing large numbers of jellyfish into the beaches along the Volusia County coastline.
Oh.
Now, over the weekend, there were several hundred people treated for jellyfish stings. Now, I have my own cure for a jellyfish sting, and you have yours. Would you like to share that with everyone?
Well, it's not my cure, but I've always been told if you're stung by a jellyfish, have your neighbor urinate on the area.
Yeah, well, when I lived in Florida, we used Adolph's meat tenderizer, and I think I'd rather do that cure.
We'll have to consult Jim Govell later.
I think we shall. Jim will have the answer for us.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's stop into Georgia on our way west. Atlanta. Zoo Atlanta's two golden lion tamarins and their newborn are being featured on Animal Planet Live, a live streaming internet show. Now, as we know, the golden lion tamarins are an endangered species.
Yes, they
are. Native to Brazil.
Yep.
And quite beautiful creatures.
They certainly are. And to tell you the truth, I'm trying to remember what zoo has them in captivity. I've seen them once or twice, but quite extraordinary. I couldn't even imagine seeing them in their native habitat. It would just be awesome.
Yeah. Quite incredible creatures.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, here's some interesting news out of Los Angeles. researchers have found that since the 1970s, some of the Coast California redwoods have grown at their fastest rate ever in recorded history.
Hmm.
Now, the giant sequoias are also showing growth spurts. Now, this is based on core samples taken from trees that are at least 1,000 years old.
Now, I wonder why that would be, Dr. Day.
Boy, I don't know.
We need to have your staff do some
extra
research.
That's pretty interesting, though.
Yeah, that is.
Giant redwoods are just taking off.
Yeah, good
All
for
right,
them.
All right, now, this is a world record that we really don't want to hear. Spotsylvania, Virginia, a 17-pound, 6-ounce northern snakehead that was caught in a Aquia Creek on June 1st has been certified as a world record catch by the International Fish and Game Association. Now, as we know, the invasive snakehead can breathe air, survive on land, adapt, and thrive in foreign environments.
You know, I kept a couple years ago, and when I say years ago, like 25 years ago at least, in captivity in an aquarium, and they had the most ferocious appetites. You know, the college dorm wants to put a piranha in the room. Well, they're just big chickens. They hide behind all the plants and foliage. But this snakehead, man, you couldn't fill them up. So that doesn't surprise me at all that they get that size. Wow.
And, yeah, that's an incredible size fish. And, you know, they've been known to attack humans.
Oh, of course.
This all started from somebody had purchased a couple for dinner and decided they couldn't eat them, so they turned them loose in a local lake.
Really? I hadn't heard that.
Yes. Now, this is not good news.
No.
Well, being a Kansas boy, I've been to Joplin, Missouri many times in my life, but I've never seen an alligator there. A couple found a nearly 2-foot-long alligator in a large rain-filled pothole in the middle of the street. Yeah. Now, they used a broom and a rake to corral the gator, and finally they were able to tape its mouth closed with the electrical tape.
How big was the alligator?
2 foot.
2 foot, wow.
And as you can imagine, a foot of that was tail.
Yeah, well, you know what my wife would say. Who measured that, a man?
Exactly. Now you've got quite a few gators at the Batson Wildlife Preserve.
Yeah, we do.
Now, have you ever used any other kind of tape? I see everybody uses electrical tape.
Yeah, it comes off. I've seen them use duct tape before, but the electrical tape comes off so much easier. That's and like my wife just said, how would you like to have duct tape on your skin? Yeah.
Right. Well, why don't we convince everybody to start using surgical tape?
Well, you know, electric tape works pretty good. You know the story, I was called by a gentleman who had a rental house, and the fellow that was living in the house, they basically moved him out and put him in a retirement home. So they're going through the house and inspecting it for damage and whatever. And he walked into one of the bedrooms, and there was a kiddie pool, you know, the kind you buy at Walmart, blue with the little fishes on it. And he had in that room, and it was sitting in the kiddie pool, an 8.5-foot alligator that he had raised. It was huge. And then the gentleman that was the landlord told me, he said, well, it's a big pet. He says, let me explain something to you. Alligators are very, very smart, and the only person it's a big pet to is the guy that's been feeding it for all this time. Anyone else, watch out. So,
what became of that gator?
Oh, I brought him home, of course, and he's
yep.
in the pile.
You're always doing that.
I know. I'll never learn.
Hold the butter and the lemon. Portland, Maine, I'm sorry. A shell disease that has plagued the southern New England lobster industry by making lobsters unsightly and in some cases unmarketable appears to be creeping northward to the lobster-rich grounds. Now, the disease is not harmful to humans, so that's a good thing. But here's my thought. Do you think they're maybe doing this on purpose? The lobsters are banging themselves up, so they're not
oh.
that
Well,
much more desirable.
Well, here's another. I wouldn't put it past them. Lobsters are intelligent. We set up a huge lobster tank one time for an outdoor program. We brought in over 200 lobsters. Now, I'm thinking when one dies that the other, you know, they're like scavengers that the other lobsters would consume it. Oh, no. They'd walk up to it one at a time, touch it with two of their pinchers, their, you know, their front pinchers, then walk away from it. Every lobster in the tank would do that with the one that was deceased. And after I witnessed this, I couldn't eat lobster for, like, years. It was quite a touching moment.
Well, how are you?
I got to get a Kleenex after that.
All right, I'll give you just a second.
I got it.
All right, well, you're trying to enjoy yourself on the beach, and you see purple flags. Orange Beach, mm-hmm. Alabama. Purple flags were flying on the beaches along the state coast to warn of a large number of stingray sightings. Now, over the last few days, hundreds of people have complained about coming into contact with the stingrays. Now, you're in their yard.
Right.
You're playing in their yard, and people are complaining.
Well,
they should be happy to see a stingray.
They should be. It's like the people that feed the deer out in California. They feed deer in their backyard, and they cannot figure out why mountain lions are everywhere.
Hmm.
Close to residents, you know, same deal, same psychology.
Right, you're just baiting them.
Yeah,
all right, we're decorating in pink at the Albuquerque Zoo in New Mexico. The Asian elephant herd at the Albuquerque Biopark will be expanding. Now, the zookeeper said blood tests indicate that Rozzy, the elephant's calf, will likely be a girl.
Well, you know, a friend of the show, Doug Hodel, is the head herpetologist at the biopark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
That's right, and a very good friend of ours.
And an employee of mine when he was just a little boy. He grew up and does this amazing work with the reptiles out there. So,
yeah, we're still amazed that he's still alive, actually.
Well, yeah.
All right, how are we doing tonight? I'm running a little long. Let's do the local news. After digging for more than 25 years in a cave in Crawford County, researchers with the Indiana State Museum have unearthed the skeleton of a 50,000-year-old flat-headed peccary, which, for those of you who don't know, is an ancient pig-like mammal. Now, since the digging began at the cave, and the museum does not reveal the exact site of the cave, but more than 3 tons of clay have been excavated from the cave.
That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. They're starting to find a few more things here in Indiana.
Well, it's a glacial wonder.
Yes, it is. We had a glacier here a mile thick that stopped here around Indianapolis, started melting, created all the hills in southern Indiana.
It did.
Quite beautiful.
Absolutely.
All right, now what were you doing on this day in 1969? What were you doing August 15th in 1969?
Well, I was a junior in high school and getting ready to be a senior in high school. So I have not a clue what I was doing.
Well, on this day in 1969, the Woodstock Music and Art Fair opened in upstate New York.
Oh, I know what I was doing. I was in Estes Park, Colorado with my parents.
That's right, summer vacation.
Yep.
All right, that brings us to the Wild World Facts of the Day.
Uh-oh.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Jim, are you ready?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, Jim probably already knows all this, but we're gonna let our other listeners know. There is about 1/4 of a pound of salt in every gallon of seawater. That's pretty amazing.
Well, as Johnny Carson would say, I did not know that.
Yeah. All right. Now, the roar that we hear when we place a seashell next to our ear, well, that's not the ocean, but rather the sound of the blood surging through the veins in our ear.
Really?
Yep. Now, see, for years I thought that was the ocean.
Well, Dr. Day, I wonder what Dave Davies would say about that.
hello. You know, I wish I could fly like Superman.
Oh, my Lord.
All right, for the last Wild World fact of the day, of the more than 350 species of sharks, only 20 species are actually a threat to people. Half of all shark species average less than 1 meter long.
Well, I'm sure Jim Colville knew that, but thank you for educating our entire audience, our worldwide audience.
That I did that just in case Jim didn't get it in tonight.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's the Wild World News for August 15th.
Well, once again, a wonderful job done by Dr. Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, bringing us the latest from the natural world. We also want to thank my company, Wildlife Educational Services, and our website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, tells all about our wildlife rescue work that we're involved with, also our wildlife education programs that we present to schools all across the country and nature centers. And now we need to tell everyone that Larry Bathman's Wild World has an official Facebook page. We encourage you to go to that page and like it, and you'll get the latest information on all the amazing guests that we've had on. And tell your friends about the show. And they can download any of these episodes absolutely free of charge at Blog Talk Radio. All these things make it possible for Larry Bathman's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
If I could talk to the animals, I just imagine it chatting with a chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. Oh, what a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals and learn their languages, maybe take an animal degree. I'd study elephant and eagle, a buffalo and beagle, an alligator, guinea pig and flea. I would converse in polar bear and python. I would curse in fluent kangaroo. If people ask me, can you speak rhinoceros, I say I'm carceros. Can't you? If I can bird with our furry friend, man to animal, think of the amazing repartee. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt, squeak, just walk with the animals, and Lord, they could talk to me. I could talk to the animals, think what fun we'd have asking over crocodiles for tea. Or maybe lunch with two or three lions, walruses and sea lions. What a lovely place the world would be. If I spoke slang to orangutans, oh, the advantages any fool on earth can plainly see. Discussing Eastern arts and dramas with intellectual llamas, that's a big step forward to agree. I'd learn to speak in antelope and turtle. My Pekingese would be extremely good. If I were asked to sing a hippopotamus, I'd say why not a must, and I would. Stop and think a bit, there's no doubt of it, I could win a place in history. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, run, squeak, and talk to the animals, and they could squeak and squawk.
The late, great Sammy Davis Jr., courtesy of Shelley Leibowitz from SRI Record, Talk to the Animals. And we're so privileged to have as our guest this week, all the way from the Monterey Bay Aquarium, a big week for sharks, Jim Colville. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening.
It's great to have you back on the program.
Oh, I look forward to this every year. It's always fun to chat about some of our favorite friends out there, the sharks.
Well, you know, and I think now we're in the middle of Discovery Week's Shark Week, they call it. And sharks are kind of like snakes. They don't get the best public relations as they should.
Yeah, there's just a lot of kind of misguided impressions of sharks out there. And as we heard earlier, when you look at sharks in general around the world, the vast majority of sharks are fairly small animals, and it's only a handful of sharks that get to be very large. And out of that small group, there's really only a few that ever have any untoward interactions with humans.
Did you see the video that I forget what show it was on? I was watching it where a guy in, I think it was Florida, had a hammerhead shark by the tail. And it was a nice size one. It was 8 or 9 feet long, probably. And it was a female because as he was dragging it up on shore, it would start having pups. And here was these little baby hammerheads all over the beach, just flipping and flopping. And what was so compelling about the video is that people were actually trying to help the guy get the shark back in the ocean along with all the young hammerheads. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. At least they were doing the right thing by getting the youngsters back in there. Of course, ideally, it'd be nice not to pick them up by the tail and drag them around in the first place.
My wife said, I would tell him off for even, why did he do that in the first place? It's just, but, you know, the wacky
world. And it's funny when you look at those few cases where somebody's bitten by a shark, in a number of those cases, it's often something like that going on, where maybe they've caught the shark or they've got a hold of the shark. And most animals I know of, if you grab them by the tail, they're going to turn around and try and bite you. That's right.
And, you know, for the amount of people that go into the ocean, that live around the ocean, that vacation at near, you know, the amount of shark attacks, I think you've got a better chance to be struck by lightning twice in your life than being attacked by a shark.
Yeah, I know the odds of actually being attacked by a shark are so slim. And when you look at worldwide, you know, it's probably less than a couple dozen documented cases per year. And out of those, if one or two are fatal, that's an exceptional year. So it's very, very rare. And certainly sharks don't begin to deserve the reputation that they have out there.
And our good friend Billy Sandifer from Padre Island, Texas, he was quite the conservationist, and he was always talking about the terrible abuse of sharks with this shark fin soup that's been a delicacy, not so much in the United States, but down through your Central American and South American countries, where they're actually slipping into our waters and basically cutting the fin off a shark and just throwing the rest in the ocean.
Yeah, that practice of finning is something, and I'm happy to say that it seems to be increasingly, it seems to be declining, increasingly unpopular as people realize where those shark fins come from and what a cruel practice that is. In some cases, the sharks are caught, the fins are sliced up, and the animal is thrown back in the ocean. No way to propel itself or navigate. Of course, it's going to suffocate over many hours or days and eventually perish out there. And I've seen estimates well over 73, 75 million sharks a year that are caught, many of them just for the fins.
I'd say when you look at
humans and sharks, the sharks have a lot more to fear about being bitten by humans than the other way around.
Absolutely. Of course, our studio producer, Melissa Hovey, is the shark advocate for the entire world. She loves sharks, and of course, she was responsible for having you come on the show tonight. And I would like to turn it over to her because I know she's biting at the bit about talking about sharks, Melissa.
Oh, thanks, Larry. This would be our fourth year in a row, if my numbers are correct. Is that right, Mr. Covell?
Yes.
Yeah. 4 years in a row talking about sharks, which is fantastic. You know, every year I have you on, and I never get around to asking you specifically the names of the great scientists down there at the Monterey Bay Aquarium that are doing this work. Can you just, you know, rattle off a few of their names so that they get proper recognition for their hard work?
Well, and there's a couple of folks that come directly to mind. One of them is Dr. Barbara Block, who is actually on the faculty at Stanford University. Our next-door neighbor here is Hopkins Marine Station, which is the Marine Science Center for Stanford University. And she has been so heavily involved in a lot of the tagging work, in particularly with sharks and other fishes, but quite a bit of work here in recent years on sharks. And along with her, Sal Jorgensen, Dr. Sal Jorgensen, was a student there and now is on our staff here at the aquarium, and he's really devoted most of his professional life to studying great white sharks. And Sal's got some other partners down in Southern California at Long Beach State University and Scripps Oceanographic Institute down in La Jolla. They've got a couple teams down there that are part of our field research team. So there's quite a group of people that have devoted a lot of time to watching great white sharks in particular out here in the local waters.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a little bit, because I know the Monterey Bay Aquarium has been really active in their helping with studies and whatnot on the great white there off the coast of California. And I know you and I had briefly discussed about a study that was done on population estimates. My question is two parts here. What have you guys discovered on population estimates? And for those out there who don't know, how exactly do you estimate the number of sharks in an area?
Well, and that's been a real problem, because we can't really, you know, if I wanted to go out here and count deer, I could go out and look around and add up the number of animals I see and get a pretty accurate estimate. But it's hard for things out in the ocean to do that. And so the folks over here at Stanford, along with Sal's help here at the aquarium and some folks from University of California, Davis, did a tagging study where they have tagged and photographed white sharks. And we're fortunate here in California that most of the adult white sharks, the vast majority of sightings, are in a fairly small area off the coast, pretty much between Monterey Bay and the Farallon Islands off San Francisco and Point Reyes just north of San Francisco. So it's possible to see and photograph and tag over several years lots of adult white sharks. And once you've done that, then you can start to monitor particular individuals. And when you see the same individuals over and over again, there's a mathematical formula that wildlife experts use to calculate, okay, if we have this many known individuals in a population and we see them with this frequency, that tells us the overall size of the population must be X. And that estimation method is used for terrestrial animals all the time. So applying that to sharks, they came up with a very surprising number for some of us of about 220 adult white sharks here on the California coast, and that's not very many at all.
Now, when you say adult sharks, are you talking sharks that are within the maturity range for breeding?
Yeah, these are sharks that typically are about 9 feet and larger. The pattern we see pretty clearly here in California is that young great white sharks that are, and they may be 4 feet long when they're born, so they already start out pretty good size, and they tend to stay in warmer waters more towards Southern California and Baja California for several years until they get to be about 8 to 9 feet. And then they move up here to Northern California, and that's when their diet shifts from eating pretty much just fish and other sharks and rays to starting to feed on marine mammals as they get large enough to tackle something like a seal or a sea lion. So the population is pretty well divided between younger animals in southern waters and the adult mature animals that we see up here. And that adult population, as I said, is right around 220.
Do you know if they're saying how many adult males would actually be necessary to keep the population or to increase the current population? I mean, is there enough there to bring the great white off the endangered or off the list of, you know, sharks that we're possibly going to lose?
Mm-hmm. And that is a very important question right now, because the great white sharks here, this specific population in California has been proposed They already are fully protected species, but they've been proposed for listing on as an endangered species, especially when people saw, wow, 220 animals, you could lose that number pretty quickly. So at least the federal government so far in looking at that and evaluating that proposal has determined that they think about around 200 of those animals, maybe females, and that there are at least enough females to sustain this population right now, that they are not concerned enough about the population to list it as an endangered species. So that's the National Fisheries Service has made that determination. The state authorities here are still evaluating to see where they land on this proposal, whether white shark should be listed as an endangered species or not. So the thinking is that if we are careful about protecting them, and that's always a big if with any animal in the ocean, but if we can take good care of these animals, then their population may be stable and slowly increasing. And as the number of seals and sea lions increase here in California, and that's been a definite trend in recent decades, that's more food, so that bodes well for sharks. If nothing happens to them, as their food supply increases, then maybe their numbers will start to increase as well.
Well, frankly, that kind of alarms me a little bit, because you'd think with 220, even if 200 are females that are capable of breeding, that's still a pretty low number. I mean,
yeah, that's a very small number, and you worry about some natural catastrophe or some right. man-made catastrophe that it could put a serious dent in that. When you only have 220 animals, even losing two or three is already a significant loss in a population that size. So that's why the scientists are trying to monitor them pretty closely and see which direction is this population going, up or down.
Wow. Well, amazingly enough, we've already reached our half-hour mark, so Mr. Batson, are you there?
Oh, I was listening so intently that I lost track of time. We're going to take a short break. Our guest tonight, Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Lots more about sharks and other sea life. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We will be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's
Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
We will be back in just a moment with Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. We want to remind everyone that this half of the program is brought to you by McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, one of my favorite places in the entire world. Go to the website, McGregorMountainLodge.com. I'm telling you, folks, if you've never been west, if you've never seen the Great Rockies, you owe it to yourself. Basically, it's on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. You have wildlife in your backyard. I can remember staying there years ago, and I walked out the front door about 10 o'clock at night, and I thought it was one of those deer statues, till the deer raised his head and looked at me. I go, oh, my Lord, this place is phenomenal. Their website, McGregorMountainLodge.com. Also, we want to thank Peter Weimer and Kathy Weimer, and their brand-new website, ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com, has the brand-new video that was produced for the Bigfoot Weekend and Expo that we all had a chance to participate in last April. We encourage you to go to that site, download the entire video. It's hours and hours, only available for $4.99 at ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. They make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
So beautiful.
From the Vegas with Randolph group, our good friends of the show, their latest single, Empathia, they sent it off to us. And we decided we wanted to play it tonight. Great job, guys. They'll be on the show, I'm sure, in the next few weeks. Our guest tonight, though, we're very excited about, Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Way out in, I guess it's not been so sunny, California. But as I told Jim, you still have no sympathy for me. Living in such a glorious place. My gosh. Heaven on earth, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a beautiful spot.
I know our good friend Al Jardine from the Beach Boys lives not too far from there. He spends a lot of time whale watching in Monterey Bay. And he just goes on and on about that. That must be just... I can't imagine. I think it would be like the first time you saw the Rockies in person. And when you realize, when you look at the Rockies or you look at a whale, Vicki, I'm just a little speck of nothing.
Yeah, it puts you in your place when you look out there at the ocean and see all the other living things out there. You realize that, we're important, but maybe we're not quite as important as we think we are sometimes. Just an hour before showtime, I was watching a couple of dozen Rizzo's dolphins swimming around right off the aquarium. It just gives you a whole different take on life.
I'll bet. So have you decided that Shark Week on the Discovery Channel? Now, we know about the movie that came out that did tremendous ratings, but I'm sure didn't help Shark what word am I using for? It didn't help their image. A show called Sharknado.
Yeah. That was, the good thing about things like that is Shark Week and Sharknado, it gets people at least thinking about sharks. They're animals that we need to be aware of. Now if we can just get people thinking about them in the right way, that'd be even better.
Well, I know one person that thinks about them in the right way, and it's our studio producer, Melissa Hovey. I'm going to turn it over to her because she has the tremendous amount of questions and information she wants to share with you and try and get some information from you as well. Melissa?
Well, yeah. I mean, I watch Discovery Channel every year for their Shark Week, but I'll guarantee you something right now. I didn't need Tara Reid to tell me that a shark and a whale didn't have sex in order for them to be, a whale, for there to be a whale shark. I knew that. Wow. People up and down the California coast must have just been holding their heads. That's all I can think. Okay. Before we went to a break, we were talking about the estimated numbers of great whites off the California coast at being about 220. I still find that kind of alarming. I've heard that number. I think we batted that number around last year, but they weren't sure yet. So I have to tell you, I'm a little alarmed by that. So how is the Monterey Bay Aquarium involved in trying to get this animal protected and put onto an endangered species list?
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, probably our most effective role is just helping everybody understand more about great whites and their importance, their role in marine ecosystems here as a top predator and how crucial that is. And, we talk to over 1.8 million people a year here, and we have programs about white sharks that we do on a daily basis. And as more and more people are aware of these animals and have the right perspective on them, they realize it's important to take better care of them. And so that has helped create some good public awareness and public support for policies and legislation that are aimed at taking better care of white sharks. So the aquarium was active in helping to support a ban on finning that eventually went into law here in California. And then I like to think that through our work here, the support for listing the shark as an endangered species also is related to that. And in general, just people being more understanding of how important these animals are. And of course, it's other than protecting them legally, the most important thing we can do is just take better care of the oceans overall. So if these sharks have a good home to live in and healthy populations of for a food supply, then they're going to thrive as well. So as in most wildlife species, helping to take care of their home is one of the most important things we can do. And since the ocean starts in everybody's backyard or on your rooftop or right in the drain in your kitchen, you know, all the water we use around our homes winds up in the ocean, and that's where these animals live. So wherever you live, you could do something that makes a difference in the ocean and helps these animals out. We try and get that message across to as big an audience as we can.
You know, prior to the show, Angela had sent me three different videos showing the process of what the scientists there at Monterey Bay go through to, you know, rescue. Basically, you're bringing in rescued great whites that are caught in bycatch nets. And I think that's just completely fabulous. But you guys bring these animals in this, I don't even know what you call it. It's just this big white tank. And I've never seen anything like it before in my life. I was completely amazed and stunned. But if this animal, if the great white does go on the endangered species list, how will that affect the work being done by the aquarium?
Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of things we do. We have, and for a number of years now, we've worked in conjunction with fishermen down in Southern California and some of these areas where we know young white sharks are fairly common, and fishermen will from time to time get a juvenile white shark tangled up in a net. And we have a field team out there with a big 4-million-gallon floating pen that whenever any of these fishermen does encounter a white shark in their nets, they will bring that juvenile over to us. We'll put it in that 4-million-gallon floating pen, observe it for a few days. And most of those animals, if they look like they're doing well, then they are tagged and released, and they become part of a large field study program we have on white sharks. And then every so often, we'll have a white shark in that pen that is just an amazing animal that seems to be spunky and robust, and we'll offer it some food. And if it will feed from us over, and we may observe it and feed it for 2 or 3 weeks' time, and if it seems to still be doing well, those are the animals that we consider bringing up here to the Monterey Bay Aquarium. So on at least 6 different occasions, we've brought juvenile white sharks up here to put on exhibit in the aquarium, and that's that that interesting 3,000-gallon tank on a flatbed truck. We call it the Finnebago, and it's equipped with circulation systems and oxygenation systems and everything a shark needs to stay comfortable on a trip up the highway to Monterey, and we bring them up here, and then they move into our 1-million-gallon open sea exhibit, and they've spent as much as 6 months' time with us here before we release them.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that before in my life. I mean, those videos made me feel like I had a backseat pass to actually seeing the process and how you guys work so hard, you know, to take care of these animals. I know that we had briefly discussed one other time about a study that was ongoing as far as the great whites, when they leave the coast and they go off, you know, when they move out into the open ocean and to feed. And I believe they call that area the SOFA.
Yeah, the shared offshore feeding area. We also call it the White Shark Cafe.
So what kind of information are you getting out of that place?
Well, and because of the tagging work that we've been doing with sharks here, now we're starting to understand more about their migratory patterns. And so we know that most of, and of course it's only, again, about 220 animals, most of those 220 animals leave the California coast in the early part of each year and head out in the direction of Hawaii. Some of them go all the way to the Hawaiian Islands. A lot of them just stop off halfway between here and Hawaii and hang out for several months out there in the open ocean in this area we call the SOFA or the White Shark Cafe. And then about midsummer, they head back towards the California coast. And so we're starting to, we've had a few sightings here along the coast, and generally we expect to see more of our white sharks here from July through November, December. And so they spend half their year in warmer waters and then half their year here along the coast where food is much more abundant for them.
And I know there's going to be some observant person listening out there, and they're going to ask this question. Well, how do you know what direction they're going, do you have something in the ocean that monitors their movement, or like acoustical tags, or is there some kind of acoustical sensor that lets you guys know where they're at? I mean, how does that work?
Well, and there's a couple devices. First of all, a lot of these sharks now are wearing tags that record all kinds of information, position and depth and water temperatures, but they don't report back until that tag pops loose from the shark. So that might be 6 months or a year after it was tagged. So we get very detailed information, but long after the fact. It's still very important information, but it's not real time. In the last couple of years, again, Dr. Block that we were talking about earlier has set up a system of acoustic sensors around pretty much in this great white shark, the key part of their range here, and then we've outfitted I think it's probably well over 150 sharks now with little acoustic transmitters also, and so whenever a shark swims within about 300 meters of one of these little acoustic sensors, it picks up that signal and sends us a report. Hey, you know, shark number whatever just swam by. So with that now, we can track the movements of these sharks, at least where there are sensors, on a day-to-day basis. We don't have too many sensors out in the open ocean yet. That's probably they're experimenting with some devices that are kind of solar operated that drift back and forth out there that may be kind of open sea members of this sensor network over time. But right now we've got a very realistic look at their movements along the coast here through this sensor network. And the cool part about that is if you're a fan of white sharks, Stanford's actually put together an app that called SharkNet, where you can see where these sharks are moving on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. And so it's kind of cool. I have it up on my phone right now. I'm actually taking a look at Tom Johnson, they have quite a few different sharks they feature there that are tagged, and I can see where he's been swimming around here in the last few days.
Oh, wow.
So it's
go ahead.
Well, it's pretty cool. We can actually kind of look over the shoulders of the scientists as they're monitoring the movements of these sharks, especially along the coast here. And as well as read up on the background of these animals too. They have their own gallery and they've got pictures of each individual, a little background on them, and you know, with 200 animals you can get to know them pretty well, and if you're a white shark fan here, you can really get on pretty good terms with a number of the sharks in this local population.
Huh. Do you think that they'll ever have anything like that as far as, you know, to help warn swimmers or surfers or anything like that there's, you know, a shark in the area?
I don't know. You know, it takes a little while to process this data, and by the time that information is processed and logged into this system, it probably is, you know, that shark has probably moved on to the next location after that. We do know that some of these sharks have their favorite places. They hang out around Tamales Point much of the time, or they hang out around the Farallon Islands during the month of October, or they hang out around Point Año Nuevo here north of Monterey Bay during certain months of the fall or early winter. So we see patterns of where they like to hang out, but where they are at any particular moment, you know, can I go surfing here right now and make sure there's not a white shark? I don't think we'll ever have that quite that level of immediate detail.
Well, and kind of on the same note, but kind of going back to something that Larry had brought up earlier in reference to the shark finning, when I was watching the Discovery Channel this week, they had talked about a new repellent that they were still testing, and it used a pheromone from a dying shark. They were able, I guess they were able to isolate it and use that to help repel these sharks, and it was pretty amazing to watch it at work. But I know, just from my limited knowledge of sharks, that they've known about this for a long time, that a dying shark will repel other sharks, that will hightail it out of the area. So my question to you is, with this shark finning, they are saying now that the idea is that these sharks that are finned and dropped into the ocean, which I think anybody who does that should suffer the same fate, that this has caused a change in the patterns of movement for the other sharks in the area, because they'll just take off and they think that now they may not just be coming back to the area anymore. They may have been done for so long that they've just moved them out completely. What do you think about the use of these shark repellents where they're actually using a biological material from a dying shark? Could we be messing with their movements even more by using something like that?
Well, that's a possibility. I saw that same demonstration where they had isolated an element from dying sharks, and it seemed to work, at least on the species being tested.
Right.
There's a lot of different sharks out there, and so I'm not sure how much stock I'd put in that quite yet. But then the idea that if there is a lot of shark finning going on in an area and a lot of this particular compound being released in the water, does that alter the behavior? You know, would that make it a scary place for other sharks to hang out? It's an interesting thing to speculate about. I think it would take a lot more testing to see if that speculation actually has merit. But it's certainly an interesting concept.
But didn't we see the same thing happen, though, was it a few years ago, out near the Farallon Islands when that orca took out the great white? Because they said that when that great white was killed, the normal great whites that are in that area took off and they didn't come back for about a year.
Yeah, there was when that event occurred, and certainly the whites were very scarce, or at least the observation of whites, and we see them pretty regularly around there at times of the year, and sightings diminished pretty dramatically there for a while. So, you know, I don't know if that's chemical, or I guess that's one of the things about sharks, and white sharks in particular, is we still we know enough to suspect that their behavior and their maybe even their communications is fairly complex, and we can't begin to understand it or predict it particularly well. So
right.
It may well be that, you know, word got out either chemically or some other way that this is not a safe place to hang out right now. On the other hand, sharks, you know, like most sharks, wind up in the process of courtship and mating, chewing each other up pretty well. And that doesn't seem to discourage other sharks from hanging out in the area. So it's an interesting phenomenon that certainly needs more investigation.
Sure does. Well, we're fast approaching the end of our hour, but I wanted to make sure that I got this out before we ended this program. For those of you that are going to be down in the area and you'd like to check out the Monterey Bay Aquarium, first check out their website and see what fantastic programs they have going on, trying to work with and help our sea life and other animals. You can visit their website at the MontereyBayAquarium.org. So that's another, what's this, 4 years now we've done this, and it still flies by like just like that.
What a great hour. Good job, folks. That was fantastic. What do you think, Henry?
Well, it's always nice to have Jim on the show. He's so informational. We learned so much. And it was nice having Melissa on tonight, too.
Oh, yeah, and you don't have to listen to me for the hour.
Exactly.
But it was a great job, Jim. All the best. And for all the folks at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, I'm going to make it out there 1 year. I swear I am, and have a chance to see all the activities involved, and maybe have a chance to visit with our good friend Al Chardine, which I know is really heavy into the whale preservation out there in that part of California. So that's very exciting.
Yeah.
We'll try and do that.
Well, look forward to a visit here.
Yes. Our next week on our show, Carol Schofield, we'll be talking how vinyl records are coming back and some of the exciting music she's been involved with Foothill Records. And it's going to be tough to beat this week's show, but remember, you can download it anytime, absolutely free of charge. It'll be on the Larry Batson Wild World Blog Talk website forever. Nice job, Melissa.
Well, thank you, but it wasn't all me. It was Mr. Koval. He's the one with all the answers.
He certainly has those. Folks, it's a great week. Have a good week. We'll be back next Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You have been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.